Welcome everyone to the Neurodiverse Teacher Podcast. Today, my guest is Gina Dobson. Gina is a school teacher and the author of the book entitled Stop, Scapegoat No More, which speaks to the abuse of scapegoating. So welcome, Gina. I'm really excited to have you here today.
I am over the moon. Thank you for accepting me into your platform. I'm really excited for the dialogue.
No, I am too, especially having a teacher on here. I think it'll be a really great conversation. So before we do anything else, I want to give you an opportunity to please tell me a little bit more about your book, Stop Scapegoat No More, and your inspiration behind writing this.
Yeah, so it's really interesting. Back in 2013, I had free time in that I lost my teaching job due to respectability politics and not playing the role of sucking up to my administrators after they were harassing me for a year and a half. So we pleasantly mutually departed. I was wonderfully severanced, and that gave me space to kind of think about my creative and what I wanted to do. And as a Christian, I had heard the Holy Spirit say, I want you to write a book. I'm like, oh, okay. I thought I was going to be at a beach in Santa Monica, but okay. And but nonetheless, I asked what the title was, what the topic was that the Lord wanted me to write. And immediately he said, scapegoating. And I knew what it meant because I remember, you know, back in the day, it was like, stop scapegoating me, you know, stop blaming me for things. And so I kind of knew what it was. But when I had a more definitive opportunity of understanding what it was through research, I realized that, yeah, that's what it is. It's about blaming other people. And so my journey began. I didn't have a computer, believe it or not, at the time. Some kind of a malware had hit my computer. So I was going to the library and I determined I'm going to write 1,000 words a day. 7 weeks later, my manuscript was written. 8 years later, my book was published. I got to tell you that quarantine life was awesome for me because it gave me time to finally unpack and complete the things that I had started probably decades ago. And I published in 2020. But yeah, it was about fulfilling God's will to write the book. And it's just been a journey ever since trying to do it. And I look forward to where this book takes off and so forth. I forgot your second question though.
No, so could you tell me a little bit about it? So, I mean, you've touched on the idea of scapegoating, but for someone who might not be as familiar with that, could you dive a little bit into what can they expect or learn from reading this book?
So the book is partially memoir because it walks through my personal journey of being blamed for the failures of others. Mm-hmm. But then there's research that it talks about how different people, groups of color, for example, not in all situations, but in a lot of situations, specifically African-Americans since 1619, have been blamed for the failures of others in terms of like the crime, like we're the only ones doing the crime. We're the only ones having these out of wedlock babies. And I know I'm touching on Roe v. Wade a little bit, but, you know, the truth of the matter is statistics show quite the opposite, but it's just easier because of the systemic racism. A lot of times that anything goes wrong, then we're blamed for it. And so that, you know, I talk a little bit. So I have like 3 or 4 chapters that deal with that. I have chapters of even how in the intimate setting, like if you're talking relationships between a man and a woman, either partner might blame the other for what's not going right in his or her life, right? And so then there's a lot of projection and deflection. And then I talk about even people that scapegoat objects, places, and things. I had a friend, for example, I write in the book that whenever we went to the restaurant, she complained about the waiter, or she went to the bathroom, oh my God, it's so dirty. Or, oh, I just got my meal, look at my spoon, it's dirty. It's just like always not being able to accept one's own responsibility. Mm-hmm. And so I show that, like, if it's not taken, you know, care of in the more personal space, then it's going to evolve into a very dysfunctional place that we call America. I love this country. I was born and raised, but I'm seeing a lot of crime happening, a lot of incivility happening because it's always pointing the finger at someone else. And if we could just get rid of this president, if we could just get rid of this group of people, we could just get rid of these kids that are not, you know, just all of the things versus what did I do to contribute that this is not what it should be. And so it's about taking accountability while understanding the impetus for why people scapegoat.
So it's a little bit of a saying, instead of saying, here's all my complaints and my issues and my concerns, is it kind of shaping the reader to say, here's what you can do to take action, start taking action instead of just complaining and being not satisfied, start taking steps to make the change that you want to see.
Right, exactly. You said it perfectly. It's a self-help book about stepping up to the plate and also identifying whether or not two things, you are a scapegoater or if you're a scapegoat. For me as a scapegoat, I did more research. I started binge watching Dr. Romney on YouTube. Mm-hmm. And just really the more I got into it, I'm like, my God, not all of this was my fault. Because a lot of it becomes traumatic. We get into a lot of dysfunctional behavior as adults because we have been hearing so many things being projected towards us, thinking that it's our fault, that we're afraid to take leaps and bounds into, you know, when we get to adult, take risk and to make our lives better because we're afraid that we're going to mess up because all we heard as children is you messed up. It's your fault. Go ahead.
No. I like that you're pointing that out because on the Neurodiverse Teacher podcast, a lot of what I like to talk about when I'm in your seat is talking about neurodiversity and the negative messages that a lot of neurodiverse people get, which is that you're not good enough or you don't think the right way, or in all the negative messages that one might receive. And you're kind of saying that a lot of people receive these negative messages regardless of brain structure and how it really does influence kind of your self-esteem and your ability to take risk and really put yourself out there.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And if we don't have enough people in our, what I call my tribe or our tribe, inner circles that are holding us not only accountable, but also being able to be empathetic and to say, you know what, I see what's going on. I see what your mom did to you. I see what your peers, how they're treating you when you walk in the room. It's not all you. Girl, you're everything. So if we don't have that in our circle, it just exponentially gets worse. And who's going to break that cycle?
So do you talk about that in the book about how you can be one of those people, not only for the steps you need to take for yourself, but being that person who can help pump other people up and support other people so that they can get that support or feel confident in taking those steps?
I wish that I did, but I would think I was more or less trying to get just to the root causes and holding people to a self-reflection mode, but maybe indirectly. It might lead people to that because as they read the book, then they may say, I think that might be me and maybe I should. So indirectly, maybe, but that may be my part two book. I'm going to give you credit for that.
Just a little note, right? Just a little note. Thank you for this. No, but I think your message is beautiful because I think you're right. I think a lot of us don't realize that some of it is just messages that have been handed down to us. I like to talk a lot about generational trauma. So it almost sounds like a little bit of that is in there too, that we get these messages that maybe were not necessarily malicious intent, but were passed down from us from generation to generation. And we have to realize that we've got to step out of that mentality or that victim mentality so that we can kind of reclaim that power back.
Absolutely. And I think that's why there's like trauma-based education in the schools. Mm-hmm. We call it SEL, social emotional language, where we have the kids tap into what they're going through to make them aware and to do mindfulness activities of how they can appropriately discharge those emotions. So like, we're not going to let you feel it to the point that you want to go into another school and shoot someone. We don't want that. What we want you to do is to own what you're feeling, call it what it is, and we'll put language around it as the socio-emotional, psychiatric social workers and counselors and teachers, as we work with you through those dynamics that are affecting you, that you'll find a way to then self-regulate so that you don't harm yourself or harm others.
So I might ask you a little bit of a personal question. And so hopefully you're okay with this. And if you're not,
absolutely,
please let me know. But it sounds like maybe you experienced some of this in your teaching profession as well too. And if you're comfortable with it, I'd love to hear kind of what you experienced, how that you feel it might have impacted you as an educator, how you feel like it then indirectly impacted your students. Because I think it's important for teachers to have a voice, especially with what's happening right now. I call it the mass exodus of teachers this year. And I think it's important for people to understand why teachers are doing that and how teachers are being treated. Because I think a lot of people don't realize what the internal system structure looks like that teachers are constantly dealing with.
Yeah. So I'm in a really unique situation in that not only am I in urban education, but I work with at-risk kids and I work with at-risk kids that are on the spectrum. And, you know, so there's a lot of flags, a lot of bells and whistles and moving parts. And so I find it interesting that the dynamic that I'm in and the demographic of, and when I say demographic, I'm not talking about ethnicity or anything. I'm just saying the kinds of students that I service that it always lands on, well, what did you do? And this is coming from admins. What did you do that this kid did not pass this class? Because they're so myopically obsessed with how well a kid is doing academically, they're not looking with all of their lens what that kid is going through at home, right? And a lot of it is even physical. Some of our kids, they just, you know, have issues that happen during the perinatal stage of the parent that won't shift, it won't change. And then on top of that, in urban areas where we don't have the resources, because there may not be like a lot of taxpayers within our communities, read between those lines, that we would even have the economics to help our kids to be better, to give them the services that, let's say, Beverly Hills would have or something, you know, someone that has a robust economy. And so it's always the teacher being blamed. What did we do? What could we do more of? And, you know, parents, if they're not happy, and I understand that they're like mama bears protecting their cubs, they may be a little hypersensitive, some of them, and they go straight to the superintendent. Superintendent goes down to the district admins. District admins go to the school admins. The admins go to the teachers, and then we're berated in meetings being chastened in front of parents and students for something that's out of our scope of duty. Or something that we just, it's bigger than us that we can't do. And so, and then, you know, add to that lawsuits that can happen. No, they're not going to take responsibility. And so I think teachers are like, I don't get paid enough for this. And we're known to be the profession that's overly qualified and underpaid. So who's going to stay around to be harassed and be demeaned and not get paid for it?
And do you think, I guess this has all really come about, I think we've all talked about this in the teacher profession for, I mean, I've been in education for almost 20 years at this point in time, and I think we've all talked about it, but it seemed like all of a sudden post-pandemic, this seems to be not just a conversation anymore. You see people taking action and saying enough is enough. And some of it, it's almost like this realization that they didn't want to be the scapegoat anymore. Do you think that there is a specific catalyst? Do you think that the pandemic just created an aha moment?
Yeah, for me, absolutely. Although I'm still in teaching, but I've been a little more sarcastic in my thinking about, you know, what my real role is in it. Although I will always give 100%, but there's a lot of reflection when I'm on the freeway driving back home. But I think largely by my own experiences, the students, and I teach at the secondary level, the students have lost all of their social protocols. So they're very rude, a lot of them. I've been called the N-word twice this year. They're verbally assaulting someone that I know that in a particular position had to change from secondary to elementary school because she was being sexually harassed, whereby the students were following her to her car. So somehow I think for 2 years that students weren't being monitored by the structural force that they're used to at school. And then the parents, we understand, had to work. They were not being supervised. And as a result, they were getting a lot of the TikTok dares and videos that were telling them act this way when you get back to school. And they took note, and that's what they're doing. And then in some districts, they got rid of school police. That now everything's about restorative justice. So, you know, when the kids don't have any sense of fear of authority, and now you take away school police, they're running the show. And it has been exhausting, very exhausting.
It's interesting because I know that you are based in the California area and I am completely on the other side of the country and I'm in the Washington, D.C. area. But I would have to say that what you're describing compared to what I've experienced are very similar. So, and I'm sure there's a spectrum of what every teacher across this country is facing. But, you know, it's funny. I don't think that it's any one area that this is feeling impact or having these same consequences. I don't know that I've talked to any teacher this year that isn't describing exactly what you're saying. And that has been all over this country. So it's interesting that we have such different areas and different approaches, but yet we're all kind of experiencing the exact same fallout from the pandemic. Would you say, in addition to that, that you've also seen student mental health significantly increase as a result?
I would say, I wouldn't say mental health as much because I'm a gen ed teacher. So though I have kids on the spectrum, as I aforementioned, but I still teach general ed where I have push-in people like a resource teacher. So they would know more of that. They're the ones that deal with the IEPs. Mm-hmm. And I show up at IEP meeting, but they're the ones that have to identify goals and all of that. And they dig deeper, right? Mm-hmm. But I would say, if anything, there's been more bullying. I would say, if anything, and if that maybe emanates from mental health, maybe having to, get out internal rage, you know, from the frustrations of being home during the pandemic, that may be an outgrowth. But I've seen more as a result of kids not having the social protocols, picking on each other, taking out phones during the middle of class, making videos if someone's asking a question and they, you know, it's something that's considered corny, then they're being bullied right in class. So I see more of that. Just a general not caring and dismissal of what other people are feeling, not being empathetic. And so as teachers, we're trying to reintegrate empathy back into the classroom. So I think that probably the social workers would know more about the mental health piece, or the school psychologist. But just as someone who's curating the curriculum and the pedagogy, I see it more from the landscape of how they're behaving towards each other and towards the teacher.
No, it's interesting to know. What about teachers like yourself, your colleagues? Just, I think the overall feelings, do you feel like that has shifted? Just the excitement that maybe was once there about getting up every day and teaching, have you seen a shift or a dynamic change in that at all?
Oh, absolutely. I know a lot of people that didn't make it through the school year. They retired mid-year. And the others that didn't, I call them RIP, retired in place. So, you know, they're already checked out, even though, I mean, at this point, it's like, oh, how many more years do I have to work so I can get a good, you know, because we're on the pension system before I can get a full check. You know, so everybody's figuring out where they're going to retire because California is so expensive. I already know I'm going to live in either Arizona because I still want the weather. No, but I mean, that's where teachers are. Mm-hmm. And it's very frustrating for teachers like you and I. I've been in teaching almost 20 years, not there. And so I'm kind of at the midstream of, I still got probably 10, 15 more years to work. What does that look like for me? And it's scary because as a family structure is even more fractured, what is that going to look like for our schools as these kids return back in the fall? And what does that mean for me in terms of my zeal to want to continue and think about continuing in the next 10 years? So, yeah, it's definitely impacted us and how we see ourselves going forward in teaching.
No, and I think you made a good statement there a second ago, too, about what does that look like for the fall. I know in the area that I live in, and I've also read articles in Florida, so I'm assuming it's probably happening where you are, that there's a significant teacher shortage right now, given that so many people did retire or decide not to return to the profession for next year. And I know here we're in a pretty major crisis as far as not having enough bodies. And I do wonder, what will that mean for the teachers that didn't retire, didn't leave? what will that put on them if they're not enough staff come the start of the school year? Is that a concern that you've are dealing with or that you've had to think through at this point in time?
Well, I know that, and that's a great question. I know, for example, now this is a rumor, but I say it cautiously, but from what I was told that California may be stripping some of its requirements, like state tests, especially in the content areas, in order to get more people to get into the profession, even letting some, you know, students that are maybe in their senior year of college, maybe we can just have you go into the classroom early, we'll pay you, and then you can just have a master teacher over you. So I think that it's forcing the state level, the state departments, and then at the district levels to come to something very speedily in real time to make up for the loss that's incumbent, that's about to happen, because so many teachers have already, like I said, they've left, or there are rumors that, you know, they've gone out sick, and it's not COVID that they're leaving. They're sick because of mental health. Some have applied for workers' comp and making it about being under duress, you know, the sustained stress of not being able to teach. So I think districts are already preparing about what does that mean in terms of requisites for anyone to come in that's in the educational arena in college. Maybe we can get them there early. So I think that's going to happen. I know substitute teachers are thinking about, well, this will give me my golden opportunity to now become a teacher, because I don't have to go through the hoops that I would if I had to, you know, if things were right, I'd have to take all these tests, but now I don't have to do it. Sure, I'll get salaried versus getting hourly pay. But what I worry about is, what does that do for kids in terms of the quality of education? Isn't that what we talked about? No Child Left Behind. And we got rid of teachers that were not qualified. So now we're circling back to that. And it's not because it's about a philosophy. It's because we are simply concerned about butts in the seat in the classroom.
That was actually going to be my next question for you, because I know that you said it's a rumor, so I'm not holding you to it, but I had actually had that same thought when people have asked me, well, what do you think will happen if there are not enough people? And I said, I think they'll start cutting the requirements that you have to have. And I saw that as a special education teacher. When I first got into the profession, not only did I have to be qualified as a special ed teacher, but I also had to be qualified in a content area. And then you saw them take away that content area piece because there wasn't enough special education teachers. So I see that, just like you said, as something that they're going to do. They'll start taking away all these requirements or these certifications that you have to have. But I'm left with the same question that you asked, is what does that mean for education then? We're already not one of the more top tiered countries when it comes to education. Is this just going to put us further behind? And is there a different way or a better way? You know, if we were to take on like how Finland does things, I think they do 4-day weeks and they don't have homework and they don't, their hours look different. Is there a better way than just cutting certifications and essentially making it so that people who are not as qualified are in the classroom teaching our children?
Well, I just think that we need to be more supported. I mean, our kids are frustrated, and rightly so. We were frustrated. I didn't like virtually teaching. I didn't get called to the computer. I got called to save lives. And so I think that we're going to have to really get some more, maybe wraparound services around our kids' emotions, because they're just unhinging. And then the other piece of it is that you also have a dynamic of parents that are saying that the public schools aren't good for my kid because of this. So I am going to get them homeschooled, or I'm going to put them in charter schools or parochial schools. I think the ones that are really in danger of really decimating are the traditional public schools that are already in marginalized communities, because even the poverty structure is exacerbated by one or two parents dying. So the income's not coming in. Kids are going into foster care as a result of it. Just all of the things. It's like a cacophony of issues.
Yeah.
And so I think even, you know, for urban education, that's going to take on a different posture than even other educational institutions that encompass American education.
I think that's actually a really valid point and something that definitely needs to have light and a voice to it, because those are some of our most fragile children that we need to ensure have the right resources and supports when they were already being underserved to begin with, as far as resources and supports go.
As well as the rural areas as well. I can't leave them out. It's the same economically, you know? So yeah, it's, who knows? It's playing a Vegas table and see where the dice land in terms of education. And I think that's frightening to your point that we weren't at the top before COVID.
Yeah.
and we're supposed to be, you know, in the free world at the top. And I don't know, if we don't have a sound educational system, then that, of course, impairs our workforce. And then what does that do in terms of our positioning in the world and in the landscape of where we are in the global sphere? Where does it land us?
Absolutely. So. I have tried to keep somewhat of a silver lining with this. And I have tried to think to myself that it's definitely going to get worse before it gets mm-hmm. better. And I'm not advocating for it to get worse. I don't want it to get worse, because I think about all the children and the educators that worse is going to impact. But my mm-hmm. hope, if there's any silver lining in this, is that worse makes it so it has to get better. And that maybe this right. will finally be the catalyst that forces us out of what I call the old operating system, where we're still, you know, operating as if we're training these little factory workers and lining them mm-hmm. up in rows and not really teaching outside of the box for some of our more creative thinkers. I'm hoping that this will be that finally an opportunity for us to restructure what education looks like and really start to be more creative in our approach for students and for right. the well-being of staff. Because I talk a lot about the mental health of children, but I think teachers' mental health has been something that has been significantly impacted. We touched on that a little bit, but I think teachers right. definitely are going to get are going to be carrying that burden, especially coming into this school year and maybe for the next several school years.
Yeah, I mean, we've been traumatized. Everything's been thrown at us. And we have to make it make sense. I know for myself, I went to Honolulu, and even coming back, I was still exhausted. So I knew then that something had to shift. But I love what you were saying about being real about having more opportunities for kids besides the linear route of going to college is the nuance of what I'm hearing. Like, yeah, we should have vocational programs. Some of our kids, they just are better with their manipulatives. Yes. And tactile, they're just not going to do well for whatever reason. And we don't judge it. We, you know, they could take cosmetology, they could become a plumber, fix cars, you know, nothing's wrong with that. And I think we have to be real and not make it be about respectability politics. It's just not going to happen. I mean, plumbers make more than I do as a teacher. What's wrong with that? They can set their own hours. They're entrepreneurs. I'm the one that has to wake up every morning at 6 and go to school. So, and I love what I do. So I have to say that. But, you know, there's nothing shameful about someone, you know, opting out to not go to college. We need to stop shaming people that choose that trajectory. So I love that you said that.
No, I agree with you wholeheartedly. We have this mindset that you're only successful if you go about things a certain way, and we have to change that narrative. And I think for the self-esteem of some of our children too, I think we have pushed that narrative for so long. And you're right, some of the plumbers make way more money than some people who have gone to college, because we had that mindset that this is how you have to be successful. And it left out all of our trade school options. And now they're yes. the ones who are the millionaires, because uh-huh. they're the ones who were smart and held out and did the right thing. Because I assure you, if my house is flooding in the middle of the night and somebody says, you have to pay me X amount, whatever amount you want, just come turn the exactly. water on.
So you're not going to call a doctor or a lawyer.
Right. So I do think that there is a lot of things that have been broken in our educational system for a long time. And I think teachers have seen that for a long time. And we are a voice that often gets overlooked. So like I said, my only silver lining is I'm hoping that this is finally the catalyst that allows teachers to have that voice and say, now are you ready to listen to me? Now are you ready for us to share, like, this is the right way, instead of people who are in central offices who haven't been in a classroom in 30 years or people who've never even been in a classroom. They need right. to stop being the ones who are making the decisions and let teachers get down to what they do best.
Well, it's interesting. I'll give you a little tidbit. I won't name the district, but you could probably figure it out. It's a big district in Los Angeles. And our superintendent, when he came in mid-year this year, and he had a lot of the downtown central office administrators go back to the classroom, go back to the schools. And I'm told, they're like, oh my God, there's students in this classroom. What do I do? Because literally, when you go to central offices, it's not just here. And I'm not saying they don't do work, but let's face it, we're on the battlefield.
Yes.
And they're hearing jazz music in the background, pushing paperwork and deciding who they want to enter the field. And now they're forced to go back to the schools and see the pissed off parent, see the kids that's telling them to screw themselves, and seeing that they still have to deliver their services. So I think that was one of the brilliant things that this individual did. So that's interesting to see as well.
I like that, because you definitely don't hear of that happening often. And I think that is a smart approach, because you just do become yes. disconnected when you're not in the trenches. I mean, kids right. change from year to year, let alone decade to decade. So if you've been 10 right. plus years out of the classroom, then you are not aware of what's going on today in a classroom.
No, education's like technology. It's always evolving. I know a couple of times when I dipped in and out of education to pursue my own creative endeavors, when I came back in, even after like a year and a half, I was like a fish out of water. So I couldn't imagine the 10 plus year people that are now having to go back. But I say, good, then maybe they could be the next level of advocacy for us and say, wait, I know what they're talking about now. If you let me have my job back at central office, I'll make sure that they're fully supplemented. Who knows, to your point, this may be a good thing. This is a silver lining for sure.
I hope so. I definitely hope so. Cause I think you and I both are aligned on the fact that there needs to be some change, and it's going to take action in order for that to happen.
Yes. I agree.
Let me ask you, Gina, I love everything that you're doing. I love that you're a teacher.
Thank you.
I love this idea of the stop, the scapegoating. I think that is such an important concept, and it sounds so empowering. If my listeners wanted to learn more about your work, or they wanted to reach out with you, what would be the best way for them to do so?
So there's a lot of platforms, but I'll make it simple. They can go to @StopScapegoatNoMore on Facebook, or they could go to my website, which is stop-scapegoatnomore.godaddysites.com. Or they could go to my IG, which is @GinaHasOvercomeAndIsRestored. So I'm always going to be updating on one of those platforms.
I love that. And I love your Instagram handle. That's a great one. I've never, like, I like the message that's just in the name. That's fantastic.
I've been through it and I am restored. Thank you, by the grace of God. So thank you.
I understand. That is fantastic.
Thank you.
Is there anything I haven't had a chance to ask you, Gina, that you would really like to be able to share with my listeners, maybe about your book, maybe just about life in general? I want to make sure that I give you an opportunity, if there's an important message that you would like to have out there, that you get the opportunity to do so.
Yeah, I think you hit all the buttons. I would only add, and you wouldn't know this, but I'm really excited right now. I'm planning a book tour. And I'm really excited about it. I'm calling it a 5-city book tour. And it's going to be West Coast. So it'd be San Francisco, Seattle, Portland, Denver, San Diego, back to LA. So I'm excited about that, and just kind of see where that takes off, because I want to expand this and even consult districts through my book. So there's a lot of that I'm doing. But yeah, you've covered everything. I'm so glad. Yeah.
That's wonderful. Now, will those dates be on one of your social media platforms that you just shared with us, so if somebody wanted to come and see you on that tour?
Yes, on the Stop Scapegoat No More GoDaddy Sites website, it'll be there. So stay tuned. Yeah, I'm definitely working. I'm doing this by myself. I tried to hire out some people, and let's just say it's better that I do it by myself. I'm a little bit of a control freak, but also I'm finding, just a little bit, But I'm also finding that during quarantine, some people got lazy that actually are supposed to be contracted to help me. And so I just thought I better do it myself. So it's going to take a little bit of time, but I will definitely get those dates up for you.
Oh, excellent. Well, let me know too, because I'd love to share it with our listeners and update them just in case so that they have that information.
Oh, I sure will. I'd be happy to. It would be so helpful.
Absolutely. I love supporting my guests, especially my guests who are teachers, because I understand the work that you do and the passion that goes into it. So anything I can do to support you, please let me know. But
thank you.
Before we part today, I do want to ask you one more question. This is a question that I like to ask all of my guests, and it's if you could send a message to students and or young adults right now that may have struggled with school or struggling with school, either academically or socially, what would be the message that you would want to share with them?
Yes, it's my favorite. It comes actually from one of my favorite poets, Robert Frost. And he often uses nature. And it's from the poem, The Road Not Taken. And it simply says this: two roads diverged in the woods. I took the one less traveled, and that has made all the difference. Be individual. Don't try to fit in, stand out, work your gifts, and your gifts will make room for you.
I love that. I love that, especially because I find that so many of our youth are so afraid to seem different or be different than their peers, and especially our neurodiverse youth with autism or ADHD. Yeah. They don't want to stand out. They don't want anyone to see them as weird or different or look at them strangely. So I love that message that you shared. And I really hope our youth hear that, because it's important for them to recognize the power in being an individual.
Absolutely. The world is, I always say that the world is assigned to our voices, and we are the sound that the earth is ready to receive. So absolutely.
I love that. I love that. Well, Gina, thank you so much for coming on the Neurodiverse Teacher Podcast, for being here, for sharing about your book. You have been fantastic, and I am really grateful for your time and for your time sharing your messages with our listeners. So thank you so much.
Thank you.